Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello and welcome to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani. Coming up, after a video of an unimpressed factory worker, Rachel Reeves' speech yesterday went viral, I'll be speaking to a political commentator about the general feeling towards Labour and how recent policy U-turns may have affected people's faith in the party. Also, should service animals receive compensation? We'll be speaking to an animal welfare campaigner after a charity has called on police dogs to receive a pension after service. As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme. But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
Given the Prime Minister's desire to strengthen strategic alignment with our European neighbours, will he, in the interests of public safety, follow the lead of France, Denmark, Belgium and others and ban the burqa?
You're here. Yeah.
Oh. Prime Minister. Can I welcome her to her place? I'm not going to follow her down that line. But now she is here and safely in her place, perhaps she could tell her new party leader that his latest plan to bet £80 billion of unfunded tax cuts, he's no idea how he's going to pay for it, is Liz Truss all over again. Although, considering I think she was a Conservative member when Liz Truss was leader, she probably won't.
That was Sarah Poochin, new Reform MP for Ronkin and Helsby. She recently took the seat for Reform pretty unexpectedly in Ronkin and Helsby. And her first question, her sort of maiden question in the House of Commons, was about banning the burqa. Now, from what I understand, that was never once raised on the doorstep in Ronkin and Helsby, but it goes in line with what other people in and around Reform have been discussing in recent weeks. Well, joining me now to discuss this and much more is Reem Ibrahim, Communications Manager at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Reem, thanks so much for joining us. You've tweeted about the issue. Talk to me, where do you sit, firstly, on this, on the actual substance of, before I actually talk about Reform, but the substance of banning a burqa?
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Ali. It's great to see you as always. And yeah, I think it's particularly interesting, especially for those of us that are a little bit more on the liberal side of things. I mean, I am a libertarian, and so on economic issues, I want the state to stay out of our way. But I also believe that to be the case on social issues. Now, I am somebody that grew up Muslim. I think that, you know, I've got many family members that do choose to cover themselves up more than the average British person in that way. But fundamentally, it's about the principle of whether or not the British government should be able to decide what women wear. And I think that in a liberal society, that answer should be no. Now, the conversations that I've been having with a lot of people is exactly this. It's that it is absolutely abhorrent and disgusting that countries like Afghanistan and Iran dictate what women wear to the point of often death, in many cases, imprisonment. And it is disgusting for those countries to tell women what they can and cannot wear. Equally, it is disgusting and would be disgusting for the British government to decide what women can and cannot wear. Now, a lot of the conversations and the arguments in support of banning the burqa as a specific item of clothing have been around security and around the, whether or not we want ensure integration and ensure that people are able to see each other's faces. And to that I say, well, if that's the reason, it's for national security, we want to be able to see people's faces, are we also going to ban face masks that were mandatory only 5 years ago? Are we also going to ban motorcycle helmets that also mean that you can't see a person's face? Or is it actually just about the fact that these are Muslim women that we are trying to restrict the freedoms of?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the debate has been around so some of the commentary I've heard is similar to yours, right, about people who may nefariously put on the burqa to commit crime or to get away with being identified. To the best of my knowledge, the Home Office and the Metropolitan Police has not once said that this is a significant problem that we face in our community. Now, people do cover their face up, but as you say, it's often with balaclavas or it's with those weird winter things. I don't know what they are, but they work. Do you know whether it's just the sort of nose and eyes showing? The sort of moped gangs do it all the time, but I don't quite know what it is. But the conversation is never about that. So away from being about Muslim women, there does seem to be an obsession still, even in what we believe or what we like to think is a sort of liberal Western democracy, an obsession with what women wear.
I think that's absolutely true, but I also think that very specifically it is about Islam. And this is something I've been increasingly concerned about. I think conversations about immigration have certainly shifted towards the normalization of basically being incredibly negative about Islam as a religion. And the amount of conversations I've had, now again, I'm very, very pro-free speech and I'm very happy to have these conversations with people, but very, very well-meaning people that are sort of, I would respect, I thought was incredibly intelligent, but would genuinely ask me how I could ever defend Islam as a religion. Because of the specific negative or authoritarian connotations that are often found in Islamic scriptures. And to that I say, well, you find the exact same or equally as authoritarian scriptures in Christianity and indeed in the Jewish faith. But what we don't see is a more liberal interpretation being the majority of it in the UK. So I actually recently interviewed somebody called Mustafa Akhil, who's from the Cato Institute. He wrote a book called Why, as a Muslim, I Defend Liberty. And I think it's really important that the conversation about Islam and its compatibility with Western liberalism is really highlighted, because it absolutely is. Mm-hmm. And there is a narrative that is continuously being peddled that actually ISIS also want us to believe, you know, Islamists want everybody to believe that Islam can only be interpreted in the most radical, authoritarian, political way possible. But the reality is that it isn't that. So that's where it seems to me that the far right and the ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other Islamist groups seem to have something in common. They all believe that Islam can only be interpreted in an incredibly radical way. But to answer your question directly, I think that the conversation about the state and the role of the state is really, really important. And it's particularly important to me. The government, the state as a coercive power, should never have any right to tell a woman what they can and cannot wear. And the fact that a reform member of parliament at least seemed to be supportive of it, she did ask the question as it was posed, but there seems to be an incredible amount of support for it across the party. And indeed, I've seen it online where a lot of people have been saying that it sounds like a fantastic idea, mainly for national security reasons, but also for integration purposes. Now, I think it is absolutely fair to say wearing a burqa is not in keeping with British values. It isn't, you know, normal to do. Wearing your, you know, covering your entire face in that way is not normal. However, what is socially acceptable and socially normal is entirely different to what the role of the state should be. Now, I don't know if they, when they're talking about banning the burqa, are they genuinely saying that police should be investigating women that choose to cover their faces? Is that genuinely what they're saying? Because I actually don't know. I mean, there haven't been real concrete conversations from those people say they want to ban it.
It's not a real policy proposal, is it? It's because even Zia Yusuf came out straight afterwards and said this isn't party policy. I think he said, I don't even, he didn't know that the question was coming, and he doesn't understand why she asked the question, given that her own party wouldn't ban it, let alone the Prime Minister. So this is what
he said. It was dumb. Said it is a bit dumb to see to see somebody asking a question that their own policy wouldn't, that their own party wouldn't implement.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm Zia Yusuf, I don't open the box of dumb with my own party with Lee Anderson sat right there. But I'll leave it there. I'm not going to ask you to comment on that. I'm curious about you, Reem, because I like you. I think you're really well spoken. I don't know if me and you will find something to agree on. I'm sure we will. But our politics are vastly different. But I think you defend your politics in a really robust and well-spirited way, if that makes sense. So I'm curious, given reform are headed down what I would call a far-right road, you may not, and Kemi Badenoch seems to be floundering with the Conservative Party, and both parties, while being right-wing, are quite heavy, big state-focused, even as where do you fit? Are you politically homeless?
I am incredibly politically homeless. Yeah. That basically describes.
Where would libertarians go? I don't know if there's a space for you.
We don't really go anywhere. That's kind of the point of libertarians.
Do you and the anarchists in North London kind of chill together?
Well, exactly. We actually have more in common with the anarcho, you know, sort of Marxists than we do with conservatives on the right. It's a really, really good question, actually. I think on issues of things like housing, you know, I'm totally in line with the Labour Party on that. I think that it is incredibly important that we build more homes. And actually, when it comes to genuine policy, the Labour Party in government have been pretty successful. Angela Rayner has been doing most of that. And actually, a lot of the growth that we've seen has probably been as a result of what Angela Rayner has done more than what Rachel Reeves has done. But what's interesting, to answer your question about Reform and the Conservative Party and where they both fit, Reform, some of the first policies they announced were incredibly authoritarian. I'm talking about the energy policies. And Richard Tice, when he announced them, I criticised them online. I said, I sort of came up with a thread and said, these policies aren't very liberal. And the reason for that is, if I just go back, I was actually relatively surprised by all of this. I think that Nigel Farage himself is actually, you know, more classically liberal, liberally inclined. I think he probably would align with my views if we really pressed him on it. But when it came to the party as a whole, that wasn't what was coming out. And I was incredibly disappointed. I would say that, you know, if you asked me just before the election last year, I probably would have said I'm quite optimistic and quite excited by what Reform would come out with. Mm. But it's honestly been incredibly disappointing. So on the energy policy specifically, it was basically new taxes. So a tax on green energy, which is insane because it's just distorting the market in the way that green energy subsidies distort the market. I'm against both of them. And forcing the national grid to put all wires underground, which would increase their costs by about 10 times, but just because they don't look very nice. And of course, that might have appealed to some Reform voters. And banning battery energy storage systems because they are deemed unsafe by one person in the party, even though the party also claimed that they are supportive of nuclear energy. Nuclear energy is also pretty unsafe unless it's handled correctly. So the problem for me is that their instinct on energy was bans and taxes. And that's absolutely, from my perspective, the wrong
approach. But also, there doesn't seem to be a coherent, at least, this might not necessarily be a bad thing. I'm not presenting it as that. But there doesn't seem to be a coherent ideological string across the policies, if that makes sense. Similar to the Labour Party, actually. I think, in fact, to credit, I think Kemi Badenoch has a slightly more ideologically consistent policy platform, whereas both with Labour and Reform, it seems a little reactionary.
That's absolutely true, I think. I think that Kemi Badenoch does genuinely believe in something and there is a consistent ideology there. The problem is that the Conservative Party is far too big to capture that. Mm. Now, the party as a whole, the Conservative Party I'm talking about, are undergoing policy groups and they're doing this policy renewal stuff. I mean, Mel Stride this morning in his speech, I was in the room and a lot of the conversations were about, you know, the how, you know, he said a lot of the why. You know, we definitely do need to grow the economy. We need to ensure that Britain's stagnation is actually going to be improved. And I believe that wholeheartedly. I believe that the state is far too big. However, they didn't necessarily
would you shrink it
about the how.
Would you shrink it small enough to take it into a bathtub and put it under? That's quite by possibly. The way, that's such a reference for political nerds and hacks that I guarantee you my producers have no idea what I'm talking about. But I do want to actually, I want to move on because I want to get your, I'm curious about what you think about one specific policy that's come out today. And that's that 500,000 more children are to receive free school meals. So it was announced today, any child whose parents receive universal credit will be able to claim free school meals from September 2026. That was announced by the government. Currently, households must earn less than £7,400 a year to qualify. However, this change will make 500,000 more pupils eligible, which Sir Keir Starmer has said would help families who need it most. Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson told the BBC it was her moral mission to make fewer children grow up in the kind of poverty she experienced. She also confirmed the government was considering scrapping the two-child benefit cap, which has been hugely controversial. This would be seen as a sort of big state move. Are you in support of it or no?
Well, it's really difficult, of course, politically when talking about children. And I remember when Sadiq Khan announced that every single child in a London state school would receive free school meals, a lot of people were critical of it. I was also incredibly critical of it because it is absolutely unfair that we're paying the highest tax burden since the Second World War. It's predicted to increase even further. And that the children of middle class families would be in receipt of taxpayer-funded meals.
Aren't some things just principle that, you know, free school meals, the NHS, for example, I know we're going to, I don't want to have a debate on the NHS, we'll be here till the show's up. But The view from people like me would be some things are just principally, there's no, you know, it's free at the point of use, and this would be one of them. You don't agree with that as a principle?
No, I wouldn't agree with that. Mm. Not across the board. I would not say that every single child in the country should be received a free lunch, because that's fundamentally, why should the daughter of Alan Sugar, multimillionaire, why should they be in receipt of taxpayer funded meals by a taxpayer that's a shelf stacker in Tesco's?
Well, they're in receipt of taxpayer funded security with the police. Should we have them have their own private security looking after them?
Well, this is the question of anarchy. I'm not an anarchist. I would say that...
Oh, you hang out with them in North London every week, and now you're...
I might have more in common with them.
But let me ask you specifically on this policy, because it is difficult. Yeah. I understand that even with principle, it's hard for someone to come on and say, principally, I'm against children getting school meals, right?
Well, no. So to answer specifically on this policy, I would actually say that if you are a family that is on universal credit, you probably cannot afford to feed your child, or at least it's incredibly difficult to. And so I'm not necessarily against this policy specifically. What I am against is universal free school meals. Now, this policy isn't that, but it seems as though the question is about that. And I am against removing the two-child benefit cap, because the fact of the matter is, a family that cannot afford to have more children should not have more children. That is just point blank true.
Yeah.
If you already have two children, you cannot afford to have them because you are already in receipt of those benefits. You should not be having a third child. And it is extremely unfair that the rest of the country that are working incredibly hard, I mean, the tax burden is extortionate. People are working so hard, more than half of their income, in net terms is going
but
into
I think,
the tax burden.
Look, while in principle I agree that people should plan for children that they can afford, if people do have children that they can't afford, you can't punish the child, can you, though?
Well, this wouldn't be necessarily punishing the child specifically.
No, I mean on the two-child limit, sorry, not on this. Yeah.
Yeah, so but this is it, right? The families that make the decision should absolutely be incentivized to not have more children if they cannot afford to have them. Now, I'm not saying this is the case with absolutely every single family in receipt of these benefits. That's not the case at all. But when we currently have a situation where one-tenth, 10% of the adult population are in receipt of health-related benefits, something is going wrong. I refuse to believe that a quarter of the population are classified as disabled. That clearly, that metric, disabled, is not being used in the most efficient way and is actually offensive to people that are genuinely disabled and genuinely cannot work. There is far too much complacency. Part of it is because the government relaxed the amount of benefits people could receive during the pandemic because it was much more difficult to means test. And fair enough, around that period of time it was. But it's more than it's a waste of taxpayer money, because it certainly is and it's unfair. But it's a waste of human potential.
Yeah, can I just ask though, on that, the thing that bugs me always about the poverty discussion that we have in this country and in the media is it always is framed around things like disabilities and benefits, when we all know most people who are in poverty, the vast majority of people who are in poverty in this country are in work. It's in work poverty that's a huge problem.
That's absolutely true. And this isn't
so we have to make work pay, right? I mean, I would say, and this is where our ideological differences would bash. You would say reduce the tax burden so people take home more money, whereas I would say increase the national living wage and things like that so that people have more money in their pockets.
Well,
but we would both agree that we need to make work pay more rather than...
Yes, absolutely. I mean, but we do that by economic growth. We haven't had real economic growth since about 2008. I mean,
what happened in 2008? Out of curiosity,
the financial crash. A lot of it is in response to the financial crash. I mean, we had huge swathes of regulations and red tape that make businesses incredibly uncompetitive, and especially when we compare the UK to the rest of the world. Really, what I want to see is absolutely work paying. But where I differ from you, Ali, is that questions of minimum wage, I think, have huge swathes of unintended consequences. As a young person, I was on a 0-hour contract when I was a teenager, when I first started working. And when I was working, I wouldn't have been able to get the job that I did if I didn't have a 0-hour contract. Now, it is official Labour Party policy to ban those very contracts. But the unintended consequences of that are not... Sorry, the real-life consequences of that are not... Oh, all of these people will then suddenly be on more protected contracts. The real life consequence is those people don't have jobs. So I think what we have to have a real conversation about is how we can incentivize employees to pay their workers more, or indeed incentivize the economy to grow in that way. You don't do that by forcing the hand of employers, because fundamentally they'll just not give out those jobs in the first place.
You're going to get the last word on me, and I have so much to come back on. But I tell you what. I've enjoyed the conversation so much, I've missed two of my stories on my sheet here. So I've got to get you back, because as I always think, like I said, I'm always fascinated, because if nothing else, you're consistent in your views, and you do argue them very well. So, Reem, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll discuss more issues as and when they come. That was Reem Ibrahim, Communications Manager at the Institute of Economic Affairs. We'll discuss more stories coming up, including... whether the Chancellor Rachel Reeves's recent speech put a man to sleep. We'll find out more after this.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio. Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on Fubar Radio.
Danny Harmer, hello.
Thank you, what an introduction.
I heard in an interview, this may no longer be the case, but in 2020 you said you'd never actually read the original Tracy Beaker.
I've still never read it, and I'm gonna go down with this ship, and quite frankly, I shall never read it. I've got this far in life. And do you know what? I think it's kind of, in a weird way, I think it helped me get the part, because I had no idea of this character apart from the character that I made her.
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yay! The Fubar Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
If you drink a little, then drive, you risk losing your license. You risk every day becoming more complicated.
How am I supposed to get to training, Dad?
You risk losing your job.
I'm going to have to let you go.
You risk your family not looking at you the same way.
I can't believe you did that.
You risk injuring someone.
Hello, I need an ambulance.
You risk being seen as a drink driver. Drink a little, risk a lot. Think.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on Fubar Radio.
You might then see friends, family that require a little bit of support, financial advice. How do you go about sharing that advice, sharing that support without being condescending?
A practical tip that everyone can do that is low friction, send them financial content that you like. If you have a favorite content creator, if you see an article that you like, send them the video and just ask them, what do you think? And then that can begin a conversation around it.
What the Hell with Georges Bertineau on Fubar Radio.
I'm joined by Alex Mitten, retreat host and mentor.
I think a lot of people are lonely, surrounded by people at the minute. Like, you know, especially living in London, there's fucking people everywhere. But we sort of live these quite strange lives now where we're quite closed down emotionally, you know, even just like with our voice. We don't really speak that often sometimes. Do you know what I mean?
Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
We have now put our public finances on a firmer footing. The economy is in a better shape, but we have also listened to the concerns that people had about the level of the means test. And so we will be making changes to that. They will be in place so that pensioners are paid this coming winter, and we'll announce the detail of that and the level of that as soon as we possibly can. But people should be in no doubt that the means test will increase and more people will get winter fuel payment this winter.
That was Chancellor Rachel Reeves speaking in Rochdale yesterday, confirming the reversal to cuts on winter fuel payments. However, the video has gone viral, and not for the reasons that Rachel Reeves would have hoped for. It's because an employee at the factory was captured looking less than impressed at the Chancellor's speech. But is this response representative of the public? Are Labour's constant U-turns and attempts to catch up to reform turning people away from the party of stability? Joining me now is Stella Santacchido, political commentator and head of policy at Charity Catch 22. Stella, thank you so much for joining me. I hope, unlike that gentleman, you were able to kind of stay awake and in tune with the Chancellor's speech. Where do you think, as an overall statement, the public are with Labour? Are the polls to be believed? Is this a rapidly declining popularity in government, or is there more to it?
Hey, Ali, just a quick correction. I no longer work for Catch 22.
Oh, tell us where you're at now.
Great charity. Oh, I'm self-employed, so I'm a political commentator, and
yes,
I do campaigns on the side. But
brilliant.
You asked me about whether we think whether the polls are correct.
Yeah, what's the mood of the public, do you think?
Yes, I'll tell you what. I think that the public is obviously completely disillusioned because they voted for change, and obviously they didn't get change. And the picture that they have been taking from the government has been changing, right? From the beginning, we had the announcement when Labour just got into government about the winter fuel payment, which it was just one thing on its own. And since then, we really haven't had anything that sounds like a Labour government. So for a lot of people, they are very confused because they voted for a Labour government. So they are expecting to hear about what are the kinds of things that you're going to be doing that we expect a Labour government to do. Now, of course, they have increased public spending in our public services. They have done that. Perhaps they haven't invested as much as we hoped that they were going to do, and there is still massive gaps in the budget. There is still a massive problem with social care, and how exactly are you going to be financing that, especially now that you want to scrap the visas for social care workers. Universities are in big financial trouble. We're expecting a lot of local councils to go bankrupt. We have the police who is complaining and saying that they are going to have to prioritize which crimes they're going to be investigating. And now finally, it seems like the cabinet has also grown a backbone. And we have leaks in the press showing that Angela Rayner is very unhappy with the cuts she's expected to make. And that she will not be able to deliver the very ambitious housing building program that we were promised. Liz Kendall and Bridget Phillipson have been making a lot of sounds about the two-child benefits cap, which, of course, before Labour got in government, there was a big campaign inside the Labour Party to convince Keir Starmer to commit in the manifesto to scrap the two-child benefit cap. Mm-hmm. And we know that it is in the values and in the politics of most Labour MPs that they don't want to have the two-child benefit cap. But the situation is just very hard because Rachel Reeves has completely tied her hands her objection with Securonomics.
So let me ask you about the U-turns specifically, because you're referencing some of them. The U-turns on winter fuel policy, for example, and the possible U-turn on the two-child policy limit that looks like it's coming. There's different views on these U-turns. One, that what Labour will hope is that they can say we've listened to the views of the public, particularly after the local elections, and we're taking that on board. The other view is it makes the government look weak, and it makes it further enshrines this idea that Keir Starmer doesn't really believe in anything. Which one do you think is most more likely, that people will go, oh, they finally listened to us, or that they don't believe in anything and they just tell us what we want to hear?
Well, here's the problem. I think that the Labour Party already looked back for if you're going to scrap the winter fuel payment, which my opinion is that a lot of people would agree that it doesn't make sense that millionaires should be receiving the winter fuel payment. Of course, pensioners who are in financial trouble should be receiving more help, but there is no reason why this needs to be a universal benefit. It's just that it's practically quite difficult to discern who you give it to and who you don't. But after almost a year of Labour MPs having to defend this spending cut, they are now doing a U-turn. I really, really doubt that they're going to be convincing all of the people who have moved to Reform and have decided to vote for Nigel Farage who no longer seems to pretend to be a Thatcherite. Now he's apparently in favour of the welfare state. These voters are not going to budge. They're going to go for the full fat version. So the two-child benefit cap, I think, is may make more of a dent. But again, even though this was supposed to be Labour policy to begin with, they have waited until the local elections and they have given all of this time to Nigel Farage to come out and start speaking mm-hmm. about benefits as if he was ever the kind of politician who was in favour of benefits. Even though in 2015, when he was leader of the UKIP party, he was explicitly in favour of keeping the two-child benefit cap.
Stella, can I ask you...
So they look like they're trailing.
So on, there's a lot of whispers right now about whether Keir Starmer can turn this around or whether the Labour Party, particularly the PLPs who have more power in this case, might have a decision to make maybe after next year's locals. Do you think he can turn it around?
Absolutely, he can turn it around. He can turn it around because there has been some polling, which is not public yet, but it's but from 89 up, they will be releasing it very soon, which shows that the majority of the country identifies most closely identifies with the values of the Labour Party. The problem is that at the moment, the Labour Party, the Labour government is not acting, or it doesn't seem to be acting in accordance to its values. It looks as if the needs and interests of the Treasury are the ones who are being prioritised over the needs and interests of the voting base that Labour MPs thought a Labour government was supposed to serve. So there is still a lot of things that they can do. And the things that they need to do is they need to make sure that the vast majority of this country can feel an actual difference in their lives in the short term. And I'm afraid I have to say that the winter fuel payment and generally the focus on pensioners once more, yes, they are the voting bloc that is most likely to vote, but this is a voting bloc that has been prioritised by government after government. And there are all of these young people, working people, families, which haven't seen a pay rise. They haven't seen any meaningful improvement in their living situations in such a long time. So giving anything to this cohort would show to the public that the Labour government cares and wants to fight for their interests. And of course, there are lots of other things that they could be doing, not least, for example, on Gaza and Israel, where, again, we know what the values are of the vast majority of Labour MPs. We know that Labour MPs and people who are drawn to the Labour Party would rather see a much stronger stance against the Israeli government.
Of course, it's not but just the MPs, because polling today has shown 72% of Labour voters would support further action as well.
Yeah, of course,
so it's not just
course,
the MPs.
Exactly.
Well, listen, Stella, thank you so much. We'll definitely keep an eye on this and we'll probably speak again soon as this Labour government reaches its one-year term. Thanks so much. That was Stella Santacido, political commentator and freelancer, joining us to talk about Rachel Reeves' speech and the health of the Labour government. In a bit, we're going to be talking about whether... police dogs, retired police dogs specifically, should be recognised for their work by getting a pension. But before we do that, we've got some breaking news on the show. We very rarely get breaking news, but we've got them. And it's my friends at Reform that have more turmoil on their doorstep. Zia Youssef has just tweeted, that's the chairman of the Reform Party, has just tweeted the following. 11 months ago, I became chairman of Reform. I've worked full-time as a volunteer to take the party... Full-time as a volunteer, poor lad. Take the party from 14 to 30%, quadrupled its membership and delivered historic electoral results. I no longer believe working to get a Reform government elected is a good use of my time, and I hereby resign the office. And that's, I assume, resigning the office of chairman of the Reform Party. Now, Reform, in a very small period of time, after what can only be described as a rocket ship being placed behind them after overperforming what most people thought in the general election in 2024, are falling apart at the seams. They've already had to chuck Rupert Lowe out of the party and as a result had a huge fallout with probably the army of the digital far right in this country. There's been internal row after internal row, both between Rupert Lowe and others, about where the party sits on different issues. Not least, they recently supported a U-turn on the winter fuel cuts and to child cap limit, which isn't traditional right-wing policy, that confused some about where they sit, but also earned the ire of traditional right-wingers and those who sit on the right of party politics. But now a fresh grenade has been thrown into reform politics as Zia Yusuf, the chairman, has decided to resign. So in less than a year, good old Nige has lost a fifth of his party. His party chairman has had internal row after internal row, and he's only just getting started. And now on Zia, I must say, What's that old saying? You reap what you sow. You got to lie in the bed that you make. He decided that he wanted to be chairman of a party with such vitriol towards migrants, who has been home to people like 30p Lee, has been home to people like Rupert Lowe, home to Sarah Puchin, is it? Who took the opportunity of her first question in the House of Commons, rather than being on poverty, rather than being on housing, rather than being on the NHS, decided to go after Muslims with the burqa ban. He has now had the party's activists turn their heat on him. That's undoubted. If you look through his Twitter account and the replies that he gets from Reform members and the criticism he gets from Reform members, and I will speculate that having a name like Zia Yusuf makes it more difficult in the Reform Party. Yeah, that's as far as I can speculate, but you can take it further than that and you'll definitely know what I think. He's not just resigning to hand over to someone else. He says he no longer believes working to get a reform government elected is a good use of his time. Not another body blow to good old Nigel Farage. Looked easier on TV, this whole politics, running a political party, didn't it, Nige? Well, coming up, a charity has called on the government to provide pensions to retired police dogs to recognise their hard work and sacrifice. But should this be extended to cover all service animals? All that and more next.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
Couple goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When is too early to say I love you? Soph said it the night we met.
Yeah. Okay, let's just clear this up, right? When I said I love you, I remember I said it in the car.
In the cab, yeah.
In the cab, and I was like, oh my God, I love you.
Yeah, well, that was the day I made you my girlfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I said, I love you, and you were like, I love you too. And I was like, I love you, 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 I love you so much, I love you so much, oh my God, I love you.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't. Think.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We store so much of our trauma and our energy in our body. I am just incredibly, incredibly tired of keeping this trauma locked inside my body. And so all I needed to do is release it. You know, it's like going on a bender and drinking too much booze and you throw it up because you just need to get that out of your system because it's gonna catch up with you at some point if you don't.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We are joined by Miss Safia. If I could produce you a salt, what is he like on paper? Sound like we're on Love Island.
Okay, on paper, my type has to have a good soul, yeah. Good purpose and calm energy. I'm in my energy era where you've just got to come in and make me happy. I don't need you for anything. I wanna find happiness and I need him to be kind.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani. The Thin Blue Poor Foundation are calling on the government to provide pensions for retired police dogs to recognise their service and sacrifice. While in service, the dogs receive comprehensive care, but upon retirement, they are left to rely on their handlers or new owners to cover often costly vet bills. However, the charity argues that the Home Office has an ethical and moral obligation to these dogs and should continue to support in their retirement. Now, will the government roll over on this? And will this charity be top dog? Well, we're going to find out. Joining us is Dominic Dyer, animal welfare activist. Dominic, thanks so much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about this policy and why it's important.
Well, I think, you know, this organisation, the Thin Blue Poor, have been in existence since 2020. And they came about because of the case of Finn, a police dog that was seriously injured on duty. That led to a change in the law in terms of a wider animal welfare protection legislation. We now have an Animal Welfare Act where if you do, you know, try and kill or seriously harm a domestic animal, a dog, a cat or a horse, for example, you could go to prison for up to 5 years. And I fully support that. But then we have this anomaly where, you know, they are serving police officers effectively, these dogs. They are putting their lives on the line every day for the work they're doing fighting crime. But when they are retired, there's no financial mechanism in place to ensure that very expensive vet fees and cost of various treatments and food and everything else is covered. And, you know, the handlers and the people that take on these animals find that they've got significant costs. And I think the charity is absolutely right to say that the Home Office should provide that funding as a form of pension retirement for these animals.
Who's out of curiosity, who's the current owners? How does it work? Does the police, are they the owners? Do they have individual owners that lease them to the police? I don't know if lease is the right word.
It's based upon, you know, volunteers effectively from the police themselves. Often the handlers will take the retired dogs. As you can imagine, you know, they have a very close relationship with these animals and actually they train them. And in many cases, the animals will live with them in their home environment. So they get very used to the handler. So when they come to the end of their term of service, maybe when they're 10, 11 years old, often the police officer concerned will actually take them and have them as a retired pet at home. But again, you know, it's more financial stress and obligations for them. And I think that shouldn't be the case. I think there's quite a lot of sympathy, actually, within senior ranks of the police force for a change here. But it's as ever with government, it's trying to get them just to say, you know, let's do this. It's not going to be a huge amount of public money. And I can tell you, if you ask most people on the street, I think they would say absolutely right. You know, it shouldn't be left to individuals who are volunteering to look after these animals to pay expensive vet fees. And the other thing to remember is these dogs have led a physical life. So they could, you know, be struggling with limb problems. They can be struggling with arthritis. Some of them could have been injured in their service. So they will need, you know, quite significant medical care as they get older. And that's very, very costly in today's world.
And I think some of the other, and I'm a big, I have a cat. And she's my home screen on my phone. And if I'm ever too far away from her, I get very upset. So she'll have a bone to pick with you that we don't just focus on dogs. What other service animals exist? Because I think often people just think of the dogs, but I'm sure there's others out there.
Well, obviously, police horses, you know, you've got to remember those that you know, they are a significant part still of what the police do in crowd control and things like that. Cats, as far as I'm aware, are not used in any shape or form by the police as it stands at the moment.
They will tell you they're not snitches.
But that's right. But, you know, a lot of dogs are used by the military as well, of course, the military police.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know that, yeah.
And, you know, and at times, you know, they've not always acted, in my view, professionally or putting animal welfare at the top of their agenda. Many of dogs that came out of Afghanistan, for example, were put to sleep, you know, when the withdrawal happened in August 2021. You know, I was very involved in getting dogs out of a rescue charity there, NOWSAB, that turned into a major political scandal. But we did that privately and funded all that privately. But a lot of the dogs that the Ministry of Defence were using didn't get back and weren't rehomed. So, you know, my view is, as I said at the beginning, we have a very special relationship with these animals. We have an obligation to them as well.
Yep.
You know, they do an awful lot of very good, important work that helps save lives up and down the country day in, day out. And the least we should be doing when they retire is making sure that they're care is funded and paid for, and it's not going to be a massive cost to the Home Office. It's not a huge increase in the police budget, but I just think it's something that should be done.
Yeah, and I think this is something that the general public, I think, will be quite puppy-eyed on themselves, forgive the pun, but it's there generally seems to be quite a supportive nature behind animal welfare in the country, despite all of our political differences. And so this is something that I think most folks would get behind and may not know. Because I don't know exactly how police dogs and police horses have worked in the country in the past. Can I ask you, on top of the sort of vet fees and other things that we're looking at, what other kinds of support can we provide? Not just police dogs, but in terms of reforming animal welfare in the country more generally?
Well, there's a broad issue there, of course. You know, I do think we've got significant improvement in animal welfare law, and credit to the last government that saw through the Animal Welfare Act, that brought about, as I said at the beginning of this interview, the fact that you can now go up to prison for 5 years for cruelty to domestic animals. The problem I have is that wasn't extended to wild animals. That's a separate discussion we're having with the government now, because I think we need to extend it to wild animals as well.
Yeah, what's the difference, right?
The difference is that many hunting organizations and others did not want, you know, certain animals to be included in that act. So as an animal welfare campaigner and wildlife protection campaigner, I obviously do not share that view. So we're saying that actually foxes and badgers and other animals should have the same level of protection against persecution and killing as domestic animals. There's an anomaly in the law at the moment, and it really doesn't add up, to be quite frank. So if I give you an example, if you're using a dog to kill a badger, you could find yourself in a situation where, you know, you might be put before the courts under the Animal Welfare Act. But if you were just seeing badgers fight other badgers, it won't come under that act. It comes on the Protection of Badger Act. And the Protection of Badger Act, the most severe sentence you could have would be a £5,000 fine or a 6-month prison sentence. Under the Animal Welfare Act, you could go to prison for 5 years. So there are anomalies in the law that do need to be sorted out, in my view. The other big thing that needs to be considered by the government is the growing crisis we have with the cost of living in this country and how that's impacting animals. You know, we have over 14 million dogs, 13 million cats in Britain. The numbers increase massively during lockdown. The costs of keeping an animal, and you must know this, if you've got a cat, you know that your costs of vet fees has gone up, your costs of food has gone up, your insurance costs have gone up. It's really expensive to keep animals. Many people have not considered that. They're really struggling financially. Lots of those animals are being given up. Sanctuaries are full up to the brim with animals to be rehomed. So we're saying to the government, you know, and I've campaigned for this, that we need a safety net there, really. Work with the charities. We need to ensure that we can, you know, make sure that animals are protected and not left on the streets and are not mistreated because people can't afford to pay for them. And also, I think we need a situation in this country where, you know, we recognize that animal welfare is a critical issue, as you said, of concern to everyone, no matter what your political views are. You know, people across this country do care about animals, but there's a lot of abuse. A lot of animals are abandoned still. There's a lot of cruelty out there, and we need to do everything we can to reduce that. You know, one of the good things we've seen recently that I'd like the government to give more support to is having a pet food bank alongside every human food bank.
Oh, I like
that. So
that
when people go in, they can get pet food as well. Now, a lot of charities are doing good work like the RSPCA and Dogs Trust in that area, but not enough is being done. A bit of money and support from the government would make sure there was pet food in every food bank in this country, and I think we should do that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. I think what a lot of folks don't realise is just the financial cost of, like you said, of owning a pet. Not just for me, as having a cat, for example, it's not just food and litter and other things, but it's the unexpected vet bills, for example, that may come your way. I mean, just my cat was throwing up not too long ago, and just taking her to the vet just to be seen was 250 something quid, I think, yeah, just to get
a seat. There's a lot of controversy there as well. There's a sort of government inquiry now going on into practices within the vet industry on costs,
yeah,
because that's not been as transparent as it should be. Many customers of vets are saying they think they've been missold treatments or charged too much. Vets do amazing work in this country, and I recognize that every day, but I do think we do need more transparency on vet fees, mm-hmm, and we need to do as much as we can, for example, to support organizations like the PDSA and Blue Cross that are out there helping people on low incomes to get access to vet care who can't afford to pay the sort of bills that you're having to pay at the moment, for
example. Can I ask you one more thing in this area? I know we're veering a little bit off topic, but insurance systems, this is one of my sort of gripes with the system, is they'll do anything not to pay out in terms of, I mean, I guess insurance more broadly is that, but I've faced that. Is that a general issue, or is that, have I just had a bad ride?
It's difficult, isn't it? You know, to be fair, there are some very good pet insurers out there like Pet Plan and things, but, you know, they will put in additional charges when your animal gets older, or if your animal's got a if you, for example, rescue an animal, like, yeah, I did from Romania, had a historical fracture on its back leg because it came off a motorway. You know, the minute you take a dog like that into your home, it's more expensive to insure it. The insurers will say, we don't cover that. That's a pre-existing injury. So, yeah, as the animal gets older, you've got to sort of pay all the costs around dealing with problems relating to that piece of the animal, effectively, they don't cover. So, you know, an insurance is expensive. You know, as an animal gets older, you can be expecting to pay £150-£200 a month for pet insurance per animal. So if you have two or three dogs, that's a lot of money. And I think a lot of people don't consider that. If you don't have insurance, as you know, you can end up with thousands of pound vet fees. And yeah, the tragedy is that a lot of people are going to vets and having animals put to sleep because they can't afford to keep them. Vets do try to get animals rehomed, but there are so many at the moment. In some cases, vets take very tough decisions and say, well, if we can't rehome this animal, the best thing we can do for the good of the animal is to put it to sleep. And I'll say this, it's not easy for vets to put animals to sleep. It's one of the most difficult things they do. A very high rate of suicide within the veterinary industry. A lot,
yeah, it's
of vets,
one of the highest in any,
absolutely,
any workplace.
And that partly,
yeah,
is down to taking those decisions because, you know, when you lose your animal, it can be really, really heartbreaking and has a big impact on our mental, physical health. So, you know, vets have to take that action every day. So, you know, I support them, but I think we need more transparency in vet fees. I think we need more government support to help people that can't look after their animals properly. And we need more responsible guardianship of dogs and cats. And, you know, I personally think a dog license might not be a bad idea if you brought it back, but you need to put enough money into it, yeah, to make dog ownership proper. You know, maybe make, yeah, it £100 rather than the old £10 license that no one ever used to get.
Yeah, but yeah, I guess you also don't want to discourage people who can and would take in a dog, for example, with an overly strenuous sort of licensing scheme that puts them off.
I agree with you, but there's a lot of things that the government have to pay for, you know, like the importation controls on dogs to stop rabies and things coming.
Yeah.
We have a bill going through Parliament at the moment that I fully support that's going to put in tighter rules on importing dogs, breeding dogs from abroad. All that has to be paid for. So my view would be that it's got to come from somewhere. Having a dog licensing system that, you know, like the car tax, that generates significant amount of money, and then a government agency responsible for using that to help the welfare of dogs and cats, actually might not be such a bad idea. We do microchip them all now because, mm-hmm, you know, legally,
yeah, yeah,
you have,
yeah,
to have microchips. So we are aware of how many animals there are in the country and who owns them, which is a good thing. But I think, you know, I'd like to see more political consensus on licensing, and, yeah, that debate goes on in Westminster.
Dominic, I've just got one more question for you as well, because I think something that's come to mind while we've been discussing this isn't just the sort of moral aspect of animal welfare, but the ecological one as well. Like, the animals play a huge, important role in the balance of our ecology. One of my favourite facts, I don't know if it's a myth, but I'm pretty sure it's real, is that the culling of cats when the Black Plague sort of took over London was part of what influenced the Black Plague, because cats were rodent, they would hunt rodents. I don't know if it's true, but I think, yeah, it's a good example of the importance that animals play to our ecology. So should animal welfare be involved in the discussion around climate change and green New Deals?
Well, I'd turn the coin on that. It's very difficult, that debate, because, you know, cats particularly, they can, you know, cause quite a lot of problems for wild bird populations.
Yeah.
You know, cats,
oh, I know that when she's on the window still. I wouldn't want to let her out.
So, you know, we've got millions of cats wandering around, and you could bring ecologists who know a lot about this who would tell you they kill a lot of birds. I personally don't want to see cats removed. I just think you need responsible ownership to try and prevent that and reduce it as much as possible. With dogs, you've got problems with dogs attacking wildlife. So we're saying to dog owners, you know, and farmers and landowners are very worried about this when their sheep and things are attacked. You need to have responsible ownership of these animals. A dog, if it's not responsibly brought up and controlled, can be very dangerous to people, but can also be dangerous to other animals. You know, we've had seals attacked, we've had swans attacked. So, you know, you've got to think about how you control and look after your dog in the natural environment. So I'm a pet owner myself. I come on programs like this and talk with passion about protecting these animals all the time, but I'm also a wildlife conservationist. Mm-hmm. So I can see that you need to strike that balance too.
Right. Okay. Thank you. That's been really fascinating. Thank you so much. That was Dominic Dyer, animal welfare activist, talking to us about this new program. Thank you. That's it from Politics Uncensored today. Let's see how many puns I can get in the end of the show. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. I'm a little fetchy today as I haven't had much sleep, and I'm for real. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where they keep me on a very short leash. At Ali Milani UK. If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com or via the FUBAR Radio app. We have an app. I shits you not. Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored. Goodbye.
Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.